who I am. That's where I was. And I don't want to go back there. I don't want to go back there. I know who I want to be today. I want to be a woman of gentleness. I want to be a woman of compassion. I want to be a woman of love and grace, because I believe that's what God wants me to be. There were times back there when I before I found any kind of recovery, and I would sit back in that yard and I'd overlook our house, overlook the Ohio River, and I would say, oh God, this can't be your will for me. This can't be what you want for me. Because I believe that the moment I was created, that God whispered in my ears, he sent me down to this earth, be happy, joyous, and free. And what I was living with was so totally alien to what I knew in my heart. But I didn't know how to fix it. I didn't know what to do until I came to you. And you told me that I had to surrender, and that God would do for me what I could never do for myself if I would only humbly and honestly ask God. You know, alcoholism taught me a lot about humiliation. But you and these 12 steps of Al-Anon have taught me about true humility, and that's a whole different thing. And I had to look at people in my life who I had harmed, not because I had meant to, particularly my kids. My husband and I loved our kids, but my kids had been hurt because they lived in an environment of fear and tension, and that hurt them. And you told me the strongest and greatest amends I could ever make to my children was to get better. That's what you told me. I hear a lot of talk from people who are new. They want revenge, you know. I just want to get even. And I often say, you want revenge? You want to get even? Get better. Work these steps and get better. Living well is the best revenge. And then you know what happens is this, because this is what happened to me. When I get better, and when I recover, and when I fill my life with gratitude, and when I become aware of a God in my life every day, I don't want to get even anymore. I want to pray for those people who are sick and who are still ill. And that's nothing that I do. That's the grace of God in my life. And every day I pray for those people. Still, I have a litany. And I really do it not because I'm a good person, but because God is taken me to that place of recovery where I can see them as being sick. They didn't hurt me because they wanted to hurt me. They hurt me because they are just sick. And you taught me that. They're not bad people. They're just sick people. And I can understand that because I was sick too. And the harm that I did to others, I did because I was sick. I was sick with fear, and I was sick with resentment, and I was sick with the frustration of my life being out of control. And the only way I got that sense of control back was when I turned it over to a power greater than myself. And so I went to meetings, and I left those 7 kids with their father. And they used to look at me as I'd walk out that door like, you got to be kidding. You're leaving us with him again? But, you know, I knew he wouldn't hurt them. He just would make them do bizarre things, you know, like, I don't know, he'd make everybody clean closets with toothbrushes. Now, that never killed any of the kids, but they just weren't real happy with it. But I had to do that until I got better. And you taught me to use the phone. And you taught me when I couldn't go to meetings to get tapes. And so I'd peel potatoes and listen to tapes. And again, I didn't care if they were Alateen, Al-Anon, or AA. I'd listen to tapes, I'd peel potatoes, I'd fold diapers, I'd use the phone, I'd do whatever I could do. And I began to get better. Because I was never there for my kids. I was there physically, but I was never there emotionally or spiritually, because I was always in the past, nursing wounds that had, you know, what he had done, what he had said, or I was always in the future, so terribly afraid of the future. What am I going to do? I knew I was going to be a bag lady because he didn't work. We'd have no Social Security. And you know, when you're worried about that stuff, you just don't have a lot of time to read Mother Goose to your kids. And I was always crying. I'd always be pushing the sweeper, and I'd be crying because I was going to be 70 years old, and I'd be picking garbage out. I mean, that's where I was. You talk about our thinking and perceptions getting distorted and exaggerated. That's what happened to me. And now I'm getting better, and now my kids say to me, why are you getting better? What are you doing? You're doing something. It's those meetings you go to. That's what it is. It's those meetings you go to. Can we go to a meeting? And that's how my kids got an Alateen. That's how my kids got an Alateen. And thank God for people that sponsor Alateen groups. You know, a lot of those kids didn't stay with Alateen, but that's where those top 4, at any rate, got in there, and they learned that it was not them, that it was a disease, and they know that today. And today my kids are surrounded by recovery, because the whole family, almost the entire family, you know, all the sister-in-laws and all the brother-in-laws are still in, and they all work active programs. And so my kids, you know, have gone to open AA meetings, they've been to Alateen, they've been all over the place, and they live with that. Now, if they choose, what they choose to do with that is their business, not mine. But that's how I began to make amends. And I knew that I had to make amends to my husband, too. And I did that primarily. I not only told him verbally that I was sorry, but I also changed my behavior. And that is because of you. Because you allowed me to see that he was just doing the best that he could. And one day I had to tell my husband that he could not live with us anymore because I couldn't raise my kids in an atmosphere of fear and tension and feel good about myself as a mother. And that was very, very different from the past, because before, I was never willing to say, to do what I said I was going to do, and everything I said was so angry and so full of resentment, so full of fear, and now you brought me to a different place where I have to ask him to leave very sadly, because I loved him, but I knew that I could not, as a mother, continue to raise seven kids in an atmosphere of fear and tension. And he turned to me and said, I'll do anything. I'll go to, where's a meeting? I'll do anything. And I said to him, this isn't about you. It's about me. You can go to two meetings a day. You can become the king AA. But it's not about you, honey. It's about me and how I've got to live my life. And so things began to change, and he did the best that he could. And I didn't take any action other than going to a lawyer, actually, and did the footwork, you know. And I knew that the next step was in God's hands. And I learned to do that, to allow God to push me and allow God to show me what to do next. My husband had a hobby that he liked to do, and I'm sure it was a carryover from years of flying with the Marines. He liked to fly these gyrocopters, which really are like homemade helicopters. They're just a lawn chair with a blade and rotor. And he used to fly those as a hobby. I don't know if they have them out here. They have them in the Midwest. And he would go away on weekends and fly these things, and I thought they were terribly dangerous, and I thought he was crazy. But my husband, along with my kids, anything that can kill or maim you, that's what they all like to do. I don't know why. I used to resent it terribly because he would leave me with these seven kids on the weekends. And he would go off and fly. But you told me that if that's what he needed to do, let it go. Stop the whining, stop the complaining. Get right with myself. Live my own life. Take care of me. Mind your own business, Kathy. You told me that all the time until I finally got it. And one Memorial Day weekend, my husband walked out that door. It was a gorgeous day, and he was going off to fly. And I said to him as he was walking out that side door of the dining room, Ricky, you have a beautiful day to fly. Have a ball. And those are the last words I spoke to my husband. 2.5 hours later, the police were at my door to tell me that he had crashed and died. Now, I don't know why my husband never was able, like his brothers and sisters, to get in, really into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I know that that's none of my business. I know today that he knows the peace and serenity that for some reason eluded him on this earth. And when I was at his funeral, somebody came up to me at the funeral home, actually, somebody from AA, and they said to me, because I was just so sad about this, I worried so much about how he had died, and was he afraid, and did he panic, and somebody in AA came up to me and said, Kathy, dying wasn't hard for him. Living was hard for him. And that seemed to make a difference to me. And so shortly after he died, my oldest son, the seven kids, the oldest one was only 14. The oldest one got into drugs and alcohol, and you told me I had to back out of that. I had to stay out of his way. You told me that he needed to get where he was going. And so I did everything that I knew to do as a responsible parent without enabling the kid and without allowing him to avoid the consequences. And eventually he ended up in jail. And you told me that bars did not keep God out. And I believed you. And I would visit this kid in a juvenile center where he was held for months. And I was so grateful I knew where he was and that he was getting three meals a day. And I know they probably thought I was on drugs because I would leave and I'd just have this smile of gratitude on my face because I just really believed that God had this kid in the palm of his hands. And today that child is at Ohio State University, you know, studying psychology. I And he no longer goes to AA. He said to me not so long ago, I was never an alcoholic. I was brainwashed. And I say, well, honey, you could be right. I don't know, you know? But I have these seven kids still, and they're all very much who they are. I mean, they're all really strong personalities, and boy, they really keep me humble, and they keep me on my knees, and I constantly have to do those daily inventories, and I constantly have to stay out of their way. And my sponsor always says, if you become your kid's higher power, they'll never find a higher power on their own. And your kids are exactly where they're supposed to be today. And I got to tell myself that all the time, you know, because my kids do get into trouble a lot. Not big trouble, but they're in trouble. And just in February, one of the referees for the juvenile courts in Cincinnati invited me to her baby shower. I mean, that's how well I'm beginning to know these people. There were women there that said, what are you doing here? How do you know Sarah? I said, well, we have this kind of professional relationship. But I have learned today, you know, that all I can do is practice these principles in my affairs and turn my children over to the care of a loving God. And I really believe that they will be okay. I mean, I still, you know, set rules and I still have this and that. But they're going to get where they're going to go. They're going to get where they're going to go, and I pretty much believe that. It's very different for me right now, because all my girls, two of my girls are in college, and they're away, and one girl's in Chicago looking for a job, and now I'm living with these four boys. And the other day, I'm sitting around the dining room table. This one girl just left for Chicago, so this is a new thing, me and these four boys, and I'm sitting around the dining room table, and I'm feeding them dinner, and I thought, what smells in this room? And I realized it was testosterone. You know, boys are really hard for me. Girls are great. Girls just hug me all the time, and they talk to me all the time, and the boys are like, don't touch me. Don't hug me. Don't touch me. And, you know, I try to have conversations with them, and I'll say, so what happened at school today? And the littlest one always says, what do you mean? I said, what happened at school today? What do you mean? That's all he says. Well, what do you mean? And then the next one that's 14, I'll say, well, you know, who'd you have lunch with today? Why do you want to know? I said, well, just who'd you, what do you want to know? That's all he says. And then the third one, no matter what I say, he'll say, you're wrong. You're wrong. And then the oldest one, this is what he says. What are you going to do about it? I'll say, well, you know, that kitchen ceiling's still leaking. And he'll go, what are you going to do about it? I say, well, you know, the little 12-year-old, he'll say to me, Daniel's smoking. What are you going to do about it? Michael's drinking. What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? That's the conversation in my house. So I spend a lot of time praying, doing daily inventories, you know, letting it go, believing that these kids are in the hands of God and that God will take care of them. God will take care of them. This 12-year-old just got a call from the principal. He left school to smoke a cigarette. He comes home. I said, Daniel, you can't leave school to smoke a cigarette. You're 12 years old. Get a nicotine patch, but you can't leave school to smoke cigarettes. Oh! They're going to be fine. They're right where they're supposed to be. They're going to be fine. I know they are. So I need to get away, and I do. I swim in the morning. I leave the house 4:15, and I go underwater, and I just swim. I do. It's quiet. I just go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. I just swim, and it's very, very quiet. And then I read my little literature, and I say my little prayers, and I make sure that I spend at least 15 minutes a day where it's quiet, and I just sit and think. I have got to carve out of my day time for prayer and meditation, or I lose it very, very quickly. And where I swim, which is a very, very old Y, it's an old Y in the city, along the side of the tile, it says in big tile letters, do not swim alone. And I take that to heart because, you see, alcoholism took me into isolation and self-pity. But this program of recovery has led me into fellowship and community and compassion. So I don't swim alone anymore. I use that phone. I use my sponsor. I call people. I run with people who are recovering. And my life is very, very different today. The experience of God in my life has changed me. And I really believe, you know, that to practice these principles in all my affairs is crucial for me to live with serenity and so that I can become the kind of woman that I believe God calls me to be. And when I sponsor women, that's one question I always ask them. I sponsor this one woman who was so mad at her ex-husband. She said to me not so long ago, I'm going to take those golf clubs out of the garage, and I'm going over to his apartment, and I'm going to ring the doorbell, and as soon as he answers the doorbell, I'm throwing the golf clubs in his face. And I said to her, Debbie, is that the kind of woman you want to be? She said, no. I said, well, then why are you going to do that? I mean, that's what I think. Who do I want to be today? And then that's who I act like, even when I don't feel like it. Who cares how I feel? That's what I say to these women. I respond, who cares how you feel? Who do you want to be? Who do you want to be? And that's what I know is important for me today in practicing these principles of all my affairs. And an important part of that is giving away what I've been given, is giving away what I've been given, is working with newcomers, is to doing those detox meetings. And when somebody calls and asks me to do something, I say yes. When I was walking out of my motel room today, just an hour ago, the woman was pushing the cart and she said, are you ready for service? And I said, yes. And I thought, oh God, she means room service. My mother thinks I'm in a cult, and that's okay. That's all right. My mother, she can think I'm in a cult, but I know where I need to be. I was in Washington, D.C. not so long ago visiting a friend who's not in Al-Anon or in AA, and we were talking, you know, about her husband had just left her, ugly divorce, and she was talking about how angry she was and bitter she was and blah, 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 blah. And we were up like on this mountain area, you know, and I was telling her what I know, you know, that I need to take responsibility for myself, and I was sharing with her my experience. And all of a sudden, down below us from these rocks, a little blonde, about a 19-year-old blonde, she had a little tattoo on her arm, and she was smoking a cigarette. She poked her head out from these rocks. She must have been listening to our conversation. And she said, is somebody up there a friend of Bill W.'s? And I thought, oh my God, I am in a cult. So, I don't know. All I know is today that I'm very, very grateful. I would not want to have to relive what I've lived, but boy, I don't regret that any of it happened to me, because it has allowed me and brought me to a place that I'm very happy, that I'm very happy to be. I'm on my way. I'm not there yet, but I'm on my way. And so when my mother says to me, Kathy, why do you keep going to Al-Anon? Rick is dead. I say, Mom, I keep going because I'm not. Thank you very much for listening.